Now, at this point, a couple of questions arise. If the group, if a group, if any group, does not consist of individuals, then what does it consist of? And two, what should be the attitude of the individual towards the group, or towards a group, or groups in general? So let's deal with each of these questions in turn. What does the group consist of? Well, it consists of people who are not individuals. In other words, not individuals in the sense defined. And in Buddhism, there's a special term for them, a special name for them. They're called Trithaljanas, which can be translated as ordinary folk. And they are sharply contrasted in Buddhism with the Aryas, the true individuals. And this is rather interesting, you know. In English, we don't have a proper term, really, for members of a group, a term which really distinguishes them from individuals, real individuals. But in Pali, there is this sort of nomenclature, the Arya, the individual, and the Prithagjana, the ordinary folk. And as I said, they're sharply distinguished. And this is something that doesn't fit in with our contemporary modern democratic ideas at all. We like to think that everybody is the same, everybody is equal, and we tend to resent any suggestion that some people might be more developed than others, and that some might be Aryas and others Prithagjanas and so on. But this is absolutely fundamental to the whole traditional Buddhist way of thinking. And even though we don't have, in English, any particular word, any particular term for people who are just members of groups who have not developed real individuality, we can perhaps call them, and this is only a suggestion, statistical individuals. They're individuals in the sense they can be counted separately. In other words, they've got separate bodies. They've even got separate votes. But they don't have separate minds. They don't have minds of their own. Their minds, such as they are usually submerged, as it were, to speak metaphorically, in the group mind, even the group soul. They're not really self-conscious, or only in a very rudimentary way. And they're not certainly independent. And they tend to think and feel and act together with other members of the group, not as individuals. Now, what should be the attitude of the individual towards such people, towards groups, or a group, any group? Or perhaps we can put the question a little differently. What should be the attitude of one who is trying himself to become an individual? And the answer is twofold. In the first place, as far as he possibly can, he should cut himself off from the group. Cut his ties with the group. And this will involve, at least at first, actual physical dissociation. And this is what is called in Buddhism traditionally pravrajya, which means going forth. Going forth from the home, from the tribe, from the community, from the state, from the nation, going forth on your own. Cutting yourself off from the group, from all groups. And this is what the Buddha did when he left home. This is called his great renunciation. Abhinishkramana, his great going forth, his pravrajya. So he left his family, left his tribe, left his state, even left his former religion into which he had been born. So when this happens, one ceases to be a member of a group, and one ceases to depend on the group. One becomes a sort of lone wolf, becomes an individual on one's own. And so far as the group is concerned, really and truly, one doesn't any longer exist. One just isn't there. One is dead. This, by the way, is very dramatically represented in Orthodox Hinduism, in the traditional ritual by means of which one becomes a full-timer, a wanderer, according to Hindu tradition. What does one do? In Hindu tradition, one kindles a fire, a sort of sacred fire, and one pours libations into the sacred fire with mantras. And then you put into the fire certain personal possessions. And you end up with two things. Huh? Every Orthodox Hindu layman, as we would say, has a little tuft of hair growing on the crown. Hmm? It's called his tiki. Hmm? Some irreverent Europeans call it his pigtail. Huh? But it's very short. Huh? And it's sometimes, you know, curly. But it's snipped off and it's put into the sacred fire. Hmm? And then last of all, he takes off, if he's a caste Hindu, his sacred thread, which makes him a Brahmin or Kshatriya or Vaishya. And even that is thrown into the sacred fire and is consumed. In other words, he even gives up caste. And this is a tremendous thing, you know, for a Hindu, because Hindu social life is absolutely pervaded by caste. You can't get away from it. Whether you want to marry or dine or go out with anyone, caste. Caste the whole time. What is your caste? Are you lower caste? Are you higher caste? Are you maybe untouchable or unseeable even? What is your caste? Caste is absolutely ubiquitous and all-pervading in Indian social life. But on this occasion, the initiate gives up his caste. He gives up his social identity itself. And this, as I've said, is a tremendous thing in India. And what does he do after that? He isn't finished by any means. He then performs himself his own funeral ceremony. He acts as the priest of his own cremation. And it's just as though he had died, and the new self, as he is now, he performs the funeral ceremony of the old. And according to Hindu tradition, thereafter, he is civilly dead. He has no civil rights. He has no rights under law. He cannot inherit property because he doesn't exist. He just passed over. If there's any property to be inherited, well, it goes to his son if he had one, or to his brother, but he just doesn't exist anymore. He cannot go to law. Whatever you do to him, he can't take recourse to the law, because the law, it was not in modern India, but in former traditional India, the law does not recognize his existence. He's dead. He's gone. And of course he can't get married, because no woman could marry a ghost. So he's absolutely civilly dead. He doesn't belong to the group anymore. So far as the group is concerned, he just doesn't exist. So this is a rather terrible and striking sort of illustration from the Hindu tradition, which is kept up to a great extent even today. And it illustrates in this very dramatic and very tremendous way that if you want to be a real individual, you have to cut yourself off from the group, and so far as the group is concerned, just no longer exist. That is to say, on their terms, their group terms. And in the second place, one who is trying to become an individual should encourage others also to become individuals. One can't absolutely, physically cut oneself off from contact with people who are members of groups, even though they're not individuals. One can't do this completely, permanently. One may even have to remain very, very nominally a member of a group. But all the time, in a sense, one will be doing one's best to disrupt it, to encourage people who are now just members of groups, participating in the group mind, as it were, with no minds of their own. One will encourage them as much as one can to become individuals. In this sort of life, there's always the possibility, always the danger, of self-deception. Sometimes you may say to yourself, well, what does it matter? I need not actually go away physically if I'm just sort of free of it all in my mind. But you don't ever really know whether you are free of it in your mind unless you make, at least sometimes, in some respects, the actual experiment. You might say, well, I can get on perfectly well without my family, but how do you know? Try it. Just go abroad for a year or 2 years and see. If you can really get on without them, you don't know until you've made the experiment. Say, you might say, well, I'm quite happy. You're living anywhere in the world. I don't want to live in England. Well, you go and live in Iceland. Or you go in and live perhaps in some South Sea island and see whether you're equally happy there, in a totally different environment. Or see if you're equally happy even though you're not speaking English, maybe for months on end. Speaking a totally different language, and not seeing anything familiar or anything that you've been used to since your childhood or since your birth. So it's very easy to say, as it were, to oneself, well, it's enough to dissociate yourself subjectively from group attitudes. Eh? You don't actually have to go away from any particular group. Eh? But one really needs to be sure of this, and you can only be sure of it if you make the experiment and separate yourself at least from some groups sometimes and see how you actually do fare on your own.